You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode number 150 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello! Fitting that this is the KJ Wright edition of the Pelton Cast.
I didn't even think about that because I was so busy thinking about the fact that it was just like, you know, a nice round number, 150 episodes for us.
Well, congrats to us.
Congrats to KJ Wright. We'll get into that in a bit, that he's back with the Seahawks. But we have several things to toast to this week, so let's get right into what we're drinking this week.
We are drinking from Spetzel, Texas, the Shiner All Natural Ruby Redbird Grapefruit, where Ruby Redbird with ginger and grapefruit. I can tell you that I was in Texas last week, and I drank a lot of Shiner. Drank even more Lone Star.
I was going to say.
But I didn't even see one of these.
Interesting. I think I had one of these when we went. No, maybe I didn't, actually. I don't think
this can be found in the city of Austin.
I've had one in San Antonio, though. That's the first time I had it, I know, was in San Antonio.
They're strictly on the Riverwalk.
NBA Finals. Well, they might be. Okay, first up, a toast to the 10th anniversary of the first ever Sounders match. The 3-0 win over the New York Red Bulls.
Which we've been talking about a lot lately.
March 2009. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that inaugural 2009 season for the Sounders a few weeks ago leading into their season opener. Also, a toast to third Pelton brother, Talking Taco Time correspondent, man on the streets in the Taco Times out there for us, Randy Cote. Happy birthday. On Tuesday as we record this.
I wish that we could toast a crisp chicken burrito to you, Randy.
But we can't because it wasn't in the bracket. More on that in a second. And lastly, we're pouring one out for Max Unger, who announced his retirement last weekend after 10 seasons in the NFL, including the first six with the Seahawks, the starting center, the man who was snapping the ball to Russell Wilson during the aforementioned Super Bowl 48.
Oh, R.I.P.
Good luck in retirement.
a player who you don't see a lot of player for player trades that happen. This one obviously including a draft pick too, but
a pretty substantial draft pick.
I mean, losing Max Unger in that trade kind of sent the Seahawks offensive line out of whack for 4 or 5 seasons there.
Yeah, the idea that they were going to cut Max Unger had they not traded him did not age well, let's say. In the parlance of, have you listened to the Ringer NFL shows?
No, I thought it was coming out on Wednesday.
I may have given you some bad information on that. It came out on Monday, so I listened to that on my drive here, actually.
There's bad intel.
Yeah.
How was it? Was it good?
It was very good. It's a recap. They're doing the, so they do the
Don't spoil who wins.
I know. They do the Rewatchables podcast. This time, they decided to do the Sports Rewatchables. As Third Pelton brother Ben B pointed out, they did two of the most momentum sporting events in Seattle sports history. Both the NFC Championship game in 2014, the tip play, Richard Sherman's Time to Shine, and then also the Golden State Warriors coming from behind in Game 6 of the 2016 Western Conference Finals to defeat the Oklahoma City Thunder and keep Oklahoma City from winning championship.
I was listening to that one and still getting kind of scared. I probably will do the same thing in this one when the 49ers are driving down the field.
I mean, it's not like, they didn't like go through play-by-play as much in this one. It was more focused on the categories, I would say.
Okay, because I was listening to that and I was like, wow, they were this close to probably winning that championship.
Possibly. I mean, the Cavaliers did end up beating the Warriors in the finals.
I know, but it would have felt different. And also, KD probably resigning there.
Quite possibly. A lot of sliding doors moments in both of those ones.
We dodged a real bullet. I mean, the most important basketball game in Seattle in the last 10 years.
I mean, the Thunder did make the finals in that stretch, but perhaps so. So we alluded to this a second ago. Taco Time Northwest Menu Madness, their tournament that we previewed on Talkin' Taco Time 2 weeks ago, in the final round as we record this, by the time you listen to it, may already have crowned the best item on the menu at Taco Time Northwest. Mexi Fries leading Crisp Beef Burrito in the final that we predicted. as we predicted, I think, too.
Look, we know that menu.
But let me just say, stay tuned to your Talkin' Taco Time and Pelton Cast feeds for a recap of this tournament. I mean, we weren't going to let this pass without breaking everything down. I definitely wrote a formula to do some analysis.
Did you really? You wrote a formula?
Yeah.
Wow. And then finally, if you haven't done so already, go and Kevin will tweet a link about this.
It's also in the post note on Sonic Central.
Go and submit a bracket to the Pelton Cast NCAA Tournament Challenge, both for the men's and women's tournament, for a chance to win a Pelton Cast hat, should we remember to send it.
Yes. Should you remind us to do so. as we revealed on the podcast we did on Sunday with our first thoughts on the Huskies being selected. Did we not toast to that, by the way? The Huskies are in the
NCAA
tournament.
We already toasted to it.
I guess that's
true. We toasted Guinness to it.
That is true.
But we're on to a new holiday.
It hasn't happened in 8 years. I feel like we can do multiple toasts.
Okay.
What new holiday are we on to, by the way? Randy's birthday, is that a holiday?
Yeah, Randy's birthday.
That's a good holiday.
Randy's birthday coincided with the finals of Menu Madness. I mean, if that's not fortuitous.
Also coincided with it being 75 degrees in Seattle.
Yes.
Yeah. More better than that, even.
The sun shined on you, Randy.
But yes, a number of people have already joined the Men's and Women's Tournament Challenge, and you should definitely join us for your chance to win a Pelton Cast hat. But the most important tournament this week is not Menu Madness. It's not even the NCAA tournament. It is, in fact, the conclusion of our search for Seattle's best ramen right now. To help us judge the final in our search for Seattle's best ramen, we had to go back to the person who helped us in the finals last year as we were searching for Seattle's best dumplings, and also someone who is just reveling all day in the news that Shake Shack and Dozone are coming to Kirkland. So we are thrilled to welcome back to the pod his third Pelton brother, Zach Whitman. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, hello, guys. It has been an amazing day. A lot of big events happening, and we get to talk about ramen. So really, it's just a special time for us all.
Zach, congrats.
Thank you. No, this is going to save me literally minutes when I want dumplings. So, I mean, it's huge. And as I tweeted today, it's like right next to the Costco, the new Dozone. And it has parking, which is another one of my key criteria.
Wow.
So I am extremely excited for this upcoming Dozone.
Yeah, Zach revealed when we went to Tsukishinbo together last Saturday that
you guys went to Tsukishinbo together?
Of course we did.
God.
It's only served for 2 hours a week, so it would be hard to go and
separate tables across the room.
All right, we'll get to that in a second because we had an experience. As we often do at Tsukishinbo. But he was pointing out that if he was going to do criteria for ramen, it was going, you know, it would actually probably not include the chashu almost at all, but would include parking as the highest factor.
Yeah. I'm extremely washed up, and I don't eat like a Chili's all the time, but if you have a parking lot, that is such a huge bonus for me. So I'm very excited, especially since the new Dozone and Shake Shack are going into a like giant complex. It's going to have like 1,000 stalls. So that is high up on my list of criteria. Stalls.
I'm not sure if that's going to be enough for Shake Shack, Dozone, and Costco.
Yeah, the bang, bang, bang of dumplings, burgers, and a $1.50 hot dog plus a drink.
That's quite a meal.
Whew.
I mean, they're also opening, it looks like in the DGC article today, a Topgolf there. Which,
really?
I don't know if you guys have done Topgolf before, but that's
I have done Topgolf in Kansas City, of all places.
Oh, the cultural metroplex.
Well, I was enjoying barbecue, something else we discussed at,
sure. Yes.
At lunch on Saturday. But we are not here today to talk about this coming complex in Kirkland. We will have time to get to that in the future,
I mean,
I'm sure.
We're here with the decider, right? The person who finishes brackets for the Pelton Cast, Zach.
It's almost Solomonic, I would say.
I mean, I could not be more excited. And I'm not saying that. I've been excited. I've had the takes ready since Thursday and Saturday, and it's been tough to just have those sitting here ready, but it was really good.
Start us off with your ramen credentials.
As I told Kevin, unlike your other guests, I haven't spent a 5-year stint in Japan before. I feel like I am somewhat... under the standard, I really like ramen a lot, and I feel like I've eaten ramen in several different places and different types, so I have a passing knowledge of it, and I enjoy eating it. But again, haven't done the like study abroad for several years teaching English, so it's a little inverse here. I feel like I should be in the quarterfinals, and you should have the people who have actually been to Japan here. But again, I am happy to take this role. So
I think you said you've been to 5 of the 8 places that we had in the bracket. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, sounds about right.
Before we get into this final matchup, what were your thoughts on how the bracket played out and our analysis overall?
You know, I think that there was some, as you guys, with Katie, there was some discussion of maybe that the judging did not properly account for the different restaurants doing different things. And so I think that certainly I have taken into account in this trying to judge each restaurant for what it is and not the personal thing. I think that in general, the conceit of taking the ramen that is named after the place is right in almost every kind of restaurant. And I love ordering the most popular thing on the menu. I think that is not true for ramen. Wow. Ramen is idiosyncratic. People tend to like, I think, certain kinds of ramen. And I think that there's not really the same bonus there for getting the classic thing. And so there were possibly some episodes slightly diminished for maybe people tasting food that's not fully up their alley, and judging went along that way. Now, having said that,
that take was too cold. You need to ratchet that up a couple notches. put some extra spice in your ramen here that like Tristan wants, and take the heat level up on that take.
Yeah. So I think probably we should. I think people did not focus on actually judging how good the food was, but judging what kind of ramen they like, and that's a different thing for a different bracket. But it's fine.
Are you an Arashi stan also?
No, so I don't go south of downtown as much as I can try, so I can't pretend to be a huge fan or stan of any south end place. I actually think the bracket kind of played out just fine. But I do think the like good result, bad process is not necessarily good, though.
Well, the place that you were standing for at lunch was Aloha Ramen, which you consider sort of a neighborhood ramen for you.
Right. It's closer to me. It has a parking lot, several key criteria. No, I think Aloha is really good. But again, I don't like some of the things there. I really like the ramens that I do like there. But I think that I've found at many different ramen restaurants, I can't remember the place. I was actually in New York maybe 6 months ago, and I tried a ramen place that people really liked, and I had a certain ramen, and I didn't actually think it was all that good. So I think it really is just very much what kind you get. Now, I think Aloha is very good. I think the description of it as workmanlike was harsh. And
that
I
was you.
Kind of,
that was me?
Don't you make that I face. Really, you described it as workmanlike.
I just felt like Aloha, I mean, much like the NCAA tournament, it's all about who you're matched up against. Well, and Aloha faced Tsukishinbo in the first round, right?
That was a very difficult match.
Which went to the final. If it would have been faced against almost any other ramen, it might have won that first round matchup.
So this is actually, you did not say workmanlike. I believe it was the third Pelton brother in that episode. I re-listened to it like Arya Stark reciting the names so I could understand what had happened there. I believe it was whoever your third guest was.
Yeah, that was Tristan, Tyler actually, was the third Pelton brother on that one.
Tristan ordered the spicy garlic miso, which is my order at Aloha Ramen, and somehow managed to have the owner offer the pork belly, which I have gone to that establishment many times and have never been offered pork belly, never knew pork belly was available. So I mean, feel like that's pretty clutch.
It might have been a special thing because it was drawn on the wall, on the reader board that they have there. So they may have only had the pork belly for that day.
Okay. Because I was quite disappointed listening to it. I was getting excited because I would say the weak link at Aloha is the pork traditionally. Of course, I don't view that really as a deterrent to my ramen grading as we can get into. But the idea that you could have pork belly there was really exciting.
I like to imagine that you're going there a bunch, like goading them into offering it for you. you're like, so any specials today? Anything that could go in here that would really kick it up a notch?
Yeah. Again, it has a parking lot, so I will be returning.
Okay, let's get into this final matchup. The first location that you went to was Oink. What did you think about it?
So Oink was really interesting. It was not a traditional ramen place necessarily. It kind of had some different flavors, some different types of things, which I really, actually, I like. I think there were some more traditional ones, but also some more kind of eccentric ones, bringing in kind of some more traditionally like Chinese flavors maybe. And it was really interesting. So, I mean, do we want to go into what I ordered at each place here or just general impressions? Because I feel like I have a solid 20 maybe for the experiences here, and we need to like cut that down. So.
yeah, let's go into what you ordered.
Okay, so I spoke with Kevin Pelton of the Pelton Cast prior to attending Oink, and was recommended that I order the Spicy Kateri. So Spicy Kateri, got in there, and you order on a card, which I very much like. So you can select things you do and don't want. It's really convenient and awesome. I was a little blown back by the fact that the price is like 14 or 15 bucks for the bowl of ramen, which relative to, you know, the best ramen in Seattle, Aloha Ramen, being there $11. That's tongue in cheek here. We'll get to it, but you know, it was a little expensive, but I thought it was really interesting because you have a black garlic chips, along with kind of a kateri broth, which I'm not a full ramen expert, but it's kind of a hearty, meaty, really, really, it's a good broth in the sense that if you put it in the refrigerator and you took it out the next day and tried to pour it, it would just be gelatinous and it wouldn't pour anymore. And that is the sign of a good ramen broth. But
we're both nodding our head to that.
Yeah, checks out. I mean,
firm agree for the podcast on that one.
It was so I was excited going in, and I went at a time when no one else was in the restaurant because it was I think 4:30 or something when normal people don't eat. I have to say, started off with the egg. The egg was great. It was just a little yolky there. Just it was really tasty. I got into the main stuff, the noodles. As I was getting in, there was just a really nice bit of chewiness, but they weren't too overdone. And then the broth was really phenomenal. They have the chili oil in the spicy kateri broth, and mixing it up, and you get that really nice numbing sensation. It was really full of flavor. It was so deep. It's like I could taste it, and it was like eight things, but they all kind of fit together and just made sense. It was also very, very garlicky, and I just personally love garlic. So that was very suited to my needs. I don't know if I could have gone into a ramen restaurant and ordered something that was more directly in my interests. And then I would say the pork, which, as I've expressed to Kevin on Saturday, the pork, for me, it's by far the least influential thing, really. I think broth and then noodles and then pork, but the pork was good. So if I had to rate them, I would put the broth at a 9, I would put the noodles at a 9, and I would put the pork at a 7 out of 10.
All right. I mean, that's a good score. I mean, that's competing in the finals for the Pelton Cast search for Seattle's best ramen type of score. So you both went to Tsukushinbo on Saturday. Zach, I'm guessing you hadn't been there before?
I had never been there. So I will say that I don't think I was at my best at Tsukushinbo. There was the wait at 10:30. Kevin and I were scared that because of the Seattle Times article, there would be a line, of course. So for the third time, Pelton Cast people arrived early. We were there at about 10:30, waited again at 11.
I was there earlier than that. I was there at 10:20. I was there a solid 10 minutes earlier.
Was there any line at all?
There was a line. A couple people got there not long after Zach got there at 10:30. So it wasn't just the two of us standing alone out front for an entire period of time. But the entire restaurant was not filled at the time it opened at 11. By the time we left at about 11:45, there was at that point a couple of groups waiting in line. So you definitely can't get there at like 1 or something, but you're still probably safe getting there as it opens at 11.
I would like to bring up here that I committed several bizarre moments of complete brain fades. The first of which was when we were standing outside in line. And so Tsukushinbo, people may not know, there's no like sign. So we were standing next to this weird-looking, like, black anonymous gate, and people were lining up toward the corner of the block. And I look at Kevin, I'm like, you know, people are starting to line up. Like, why are we letting these jokers cut in front of us? And so then he, you know, told me very nicely that we were standing at the entrance and they were lining up behind us.
We were first
in
line.
So a tough moment.
That paled in comparison, though, to when you were ordering.
Oh, well, I was going to get into that, but yeah. we want to go into, because I have been thinking about this ever since. It was 10:30. We get in there at 11. We sit down, and I am so excited to order. I don't think I've ever gone to a place where I could just say one word, and they would know that's the order. And I've been told this place has one ramen. So I am in that mindset. I'm ready. I'm thinking I am going to order this and it's going to be so cool because I'm going to say one word and they're going to bring me just what I want. A great ramen in Seattle. So the waiter comes. He says, what would you like? And I said, sushi.
Oh my God.
And so Kevin looks at me quizzically, but not saying anything, like a sphinx or something. And so then the waiter looks at me just so nicely, he kind of leans down further and he goes, what kind of sushi?
Oh my God.
This is going to be Zach's sushi credentials when we do the search for Seattle's best sushi.
Next winter.
So I, of course, you know, looked at him and then realized I was being a complete moron. It then did take me a few start and stops to remember the word ramen in my computer, but I eventually did. So I went in thinking I was going to drop one word and get my ramen, and it really turned into an experience. So not my finest moment.
Oh my God. Oh, that is so good. So when the ramen eventually arrives, what are your thoughts, Zach?
Well, so first of all, I have to say that the portion was impressive because I think I had forgotten that in the podcast you guys had described, it comes with the bowl of rice, the 3 gyoza, and the bowl of ramen was probably 20 or 30% larger by volume maybe than the one at Oink. So just first, I was kind of taken aback by the volume. We got pretty excited. I do think that it had a really good smell to it, and it just, you could tell it was a really hearty, substantial. I mean, I was extremely excited to cut into it, especially considering the gyoza just came with it. And I think it was about the same price as Oink, and you were getting, you know, a bit more ramen and the extras. So overall, very excited by the presentation.
I will say that I feel like Oink is one of maybe the smallest bowls of ramen that we've gotten.
I think probably the smallest, I would say.
Are we going to just make fun of me saying sushi again? Is that why we're
leaving? No. But there is a parking lot at Oink, so. Okay, so the portion is larger. What did you think of the ramen?
So this gets, I think, a little bit into judging something for what it is. So this was maybe something a little less in terms of what I would order going into a normal ramen restaurant. This isn't exactly the kind of ramen I would order. But in terms of what this ramen was and just being a rich, porky, just brought, it was very, very good for what it was. And I think it'd be very hard to do what they're doing a lot better than that. The flavor, so it was very different than Oink. So Oink kind of had a lot of flavors going on that were kind of all mixing together. And you'd take a sip of it and you'd kind of like just process through like all of the things they had put in there. Whereas at Tsukishinbo, you were tasting this broth where it was just, I think, maybe less going on, but an incredibly strong, deep flavor of that. And it was a very, very, it felt like I was eating a meal, just drinking the broth. Overall, the broth was very good. I would also put that, at 8.5. I think the noodles were definitely good. They didn't quite have that nice little bit of chewiness maybe that I had at Oink. So I would put the noodles at 8. I thought the chashu pork was good. I don't think anything necessarily stood out for it. So I would put that at 7. Overall, though, you also have to account for the fact that there was the additional gyoza and rice, and the overall meal with those was very good. There was also a sauce that came with the rice and the gyoza that was very good. The other thing I would note about Tsukishinbo is that I think the ramen broth really changes as you kind of eat the bowl of food. And I think toward the end, the broth was almost getting even better and stronger and more tasty. And so while as I started out with that, expecting kind of a, you know, I knew what it was, it did kind of surprise me as I got into it that I was liking it more and more as I continued to eat.
I'm a little perplexed reviewing my notes here. I somehow gave Tsukishinbo an 8 for broth in the first round, and even when I actually did pick Aloha Ramen over it, I think. Or no, I guess I didn't. But it, that's at least a 9 broth to me. That's a really good broth. Maybe still not quite as good as the broth at Oink, but definitely very good.
Yeah, I think that these two are probably the best ramen broths I've had. They're both excellent.
All right. Well, have you been to Donbo, Zach?
I have not been to Donbo. That's one of the ones. I haven't been to Donbo, and I haven't been to Federal Way, obviously. Those are two of the ones I haven't been to.
That's how we feel about Kirkland. I've been to LA more times than I've been to Kirkland ever.
That is definitely accurate. That one I will go co-sign.
No, Keelan used to live in Kirkland.
Oh, that's right.
But I mean, it makes sense if these are two of the best ramen broths you've had, that these would be the finalists here, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, they were absolutely good. I went in, you know, as a kind of a salty Aloha stan, and coming out of Oink, it was like, yeah, that's better than Aloha, unfortunately. That's just very, very good. And I thought Tsukishinbo too, you know, lining up when we didn't need to was obviously an unforced error. Ordering like an idiot was obviously an unforced error, but the food they made, they pulled up on their end of the bargain really well, and it was really good. So I thought that just overall, really good ramen.
Well, I'm happy we didn't disappoint you with the finals. It was like the Seahawks in 2018, as you said, bad process, pretty good results.
Yep. I mean, honestly, it's a really tough call. It is a really tough call between these two.
Will we blow it at the end? Well, for me, after having both, I'm so sad that I wasn't able to get back to Tsukishinbo for a second time. I wish that I had gotten a flight from Austin on Friday night just to go to this Tsukishinbo ramen / sushi breakfast with you.
But then you would have had to watch the Husky game on Saturday. That would have been the trade-off.
I could have ignored it. So I didn't get a chance to go there for a second time. But for me, after going to both a couple of times to Oink, there's one bowl of ramen that really sticks with me kind of going forward, one that I feel like I'll go back for multiple times, one that just every bite had so much flavor in it. It was a unique bowl of ramen. It was something where, like, it was pretty much perfectly done for me, right? Like, if we're talking about my own personal tastes, and that is the spicy kateri at Oink. And I just don't think Tsukishinbo can really compete with that flavor-wise, right? It's an excellent bowl of ramen, what they're doing at Tsukishinbo, but it doesn't feel like something that can't be found somewhere else, right? It's like very high quality, but what Oink is doing is so good and so unique that to me, it is Seattle's best ramen.
All right, Zach, where did you land?
So I'll just walk through quickly the negatives I had for each. So I thought Oink was phenomenal. I will say that as a person who loves salt, I love a salty meal, especially a ramen. I thought maybe toward the end of the bowl, as all the garlic chips were in there floating around, it may have gotten slightly salty, and that's the only negative I had for it. I mean, I love salt, so I was still happy to just chow right through it, but it might have been slightly salty. I think on the Tsukishinbo side, it was probably the broth was just slightly one note there and didn't have quite as much going on, not as much to kind of just go through. But beyond those, I thought both were absolutely phenomenal. However, when I'm looking for Seattle's best ramen, this is This is momentous. It's important. I mean, they're going to put this Pelton Cast achievement on the front of the building, I assume, if not the block, you know, in some kind of large holographic form.
Well, with Suka Shinbo, it'd help you find where the front door is.
Yeah, it'd just be a Pelton Cast logo.
Brought to you by the Pelton Cast. I understand that this is important. And I think that what I would most want other people to experience, because I thought it was such a phenomenal experience that really showed me something I hadn't seen before, put together things I hadn't seen put together before necessarily, and just really blended things together so well where I was excited for every bite. I sucked down every last drop, thought it was absolutely phenomenal, thought the noodles were perfect, and it has to be Oink Ramen.
Wow. Will it be a clean sweep for Oink Ramen, much like it was for Dozone last year?
It will. I mean, I had some second thoughts as we were eating on Saturday, because that bowl of ramen at Tsukishinbo was, as I noted earlier, even better than I remembered it being from when we went in the first round of this bracket. And I'd be willing to wait a half hour in line for it if it actually were necessary. It's still much shorter than the line at Screen Door or various brunch spots in Portland. But it's not quite Seattle's best ramen. Like, look, if you don't want that one particular style of ramen, kind of out of luck at Tsukishinbo. And even though, you know, I don't want to overrate just the specific style of ramen, the fact that Oink does a good traditional bowl of ramen, even if perhaps not as good as Tsukishinbo, their shoyu that we had in the first round is very solid in its own right. But the spicy kateri is, you know, I agree with the both of you, what takes them to another level. I mean, even though my ratings didn't necessarily reflect it, and I wasn't quite as high on their noodles, I think, as Zach was, I still walked away when I went to lunch there with Jesse, who helped us in the semifinal matchup as third Pelton brother, and thought, this is the perfect bowl of ramen, which I'm sure it's not. I'm sure there's better bowls of ramen elsewhere, including in Japan. But of the bowls of ramen that I've had in Seattle, it's clearly the number one to me. So we are all in agreement here that Oink is Seattle's best ramen.
Wow.
Wow.
I mean, honestly, I did not expect this to happen. When we went into this bracket, I'd had Oink before and didn't really have a great experience. This was a real dark horse for me. Even the first time that we went there, I was like, that was fine. That Oink would come roaring from behind. Tough first round matchup. Roaring from behind.
I voted against Oink in the first round, you'll recall.
Clean sweep in the finals. I'm impressed.
I mean, this is thrilling. I'm so happy to have taken part in this. I feel like even though Oink is very out of the way for me, and again, convenience is my number one criteria, that broth is good enough that I will be going back, because it was just, I have been thinking about the spicy kateri broth, and even when I was eating Tsukishinbo, it was like, man, that broth I had a few days ago, though, was so good.
tempted by the fruit of another.
Yeah, and it's funny because, I mean, we talk about Tsukishinbo only having one ramen, but really for me, Oink could win only on the strength of the one ramen I tried. I'm sure their other stuff is good, but that one thing of ramen, the spicy kateri, that had everything I'd want. It had tons of flavor. It was just really, really good. The only thing I would change is I would get it spicier next time. I was worried of blowing out my taste buds and not being able to taste their own, so I kind of chickened out and went 2 stars, but that probably is even better if you add more spice to it.
All right. Well, you heard it here first from the Pelton Cast bracket decider, the man who ordered sushi at a ramen restaurant. Thank you, Zach.
Well, she's actually a sushi restaurant, technically. It wasn't that strange.
The worst thing about you saying sushi is that the Seattle Times was there taking note on what the Pelton Cast would be doing next. They have a whole crack team of people now searching for Seattle's best sushi, ready for that story when we start our bracket next year.
I mean, I apologize, but in my defense, it was stupid.
Well, whatever it is we decide to do next winter/spring in our preliminary bracket,
just know that Seattle Times will be there.
And Zach will also be there as the decider, the role he's played. Before we let you go, we would be remiss if we did not ask you, as one of the foremost Seahawks fans on Seahawks Twitter, your kind of general takeaways from what we've seen over the first week of free agency from the Seahawks.
I mean, you know, my heart still goes on for J.R. Sweezy. It's a tough loss, but I think we'll manage to get. I mean, I think it's actually smart that they're going less in free agency. You know, every year there's kind of that first wave of free agency that's just so expensive. And you see all these crazy contracts that you know are going to look terrible in a year, you know. And it is actually good to see them have some restraint. Now, again, bad process, good results maybe. And I don't know how this is going to work out. I don't know if I necessarily agree with everything they're going to do. I think there's going to be some heartbreaking stuff in the draft that really just
goes back. More running backs in the first round.
That Rashad Penny thing. I feel like I don't want to get too hopeful because there is stuff I'm going to disagree with. Now, I do think that in terms of bad process, I think the Jason Myers return is frustrating. Now, it looks like the contract structure is not too bad for that overall. So, you know, it's not a franchise breaker or anything. It's, you know, 4 years, $15 million. And I think almost all the guaranteed is in the first year, or all the guaranteed is in the first year or something in that. But it just doesn't show me good process because he was in camp. They evaluated at that time that he was not good, and at least not better than Sebastian Janikowski, which I would definitely qualify as not good, or at least not good enough to justify the dead money they'd eat by cutting Janikowski. And then after a year later of kicking, with kicking is just basically randomness, they decided that based off of that performance, they're going to sign him to a contract much bigger than what they had, you know, taken with Janikowski the previous season. So it just, to me, even if you were of the belief all along that Jason Myers is the best kicker in the league, which he's not, but even if you thought that, it was a mistake to cut him in the first place then. Something is wrong in their evaluation process when they're cutting someone and signing them back up after hitting a few more kicks. I mean, if he had missed two more 40-yarders this season, his percentage would look just right in line with the league average and nothing would be different. And there really is nothing separating him and him having missed two kicks other than just, you know, having a lucky year. So it's disappointing then, and it makes me feel like there are more things in that vein that are just going to be so frustrating because it's just elementary stuff.
Yep.
Yeah, we'll get more into it later in the pod, but yeah, I think we're all in agreement on this one too.
Okay, we're going to talk about that later?
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're going to let you go to sleep, Zach.
Okay, thank you so much.
But before we do... Will you agree to again join us for a PeltonCast draft preview?
I can't wait. I mean, listen, there won't be ramen, but I have you guys and we have the jokes, and I'm sure you guys will bring up me saying sushi again because that was a truly just a transcendent moment in my own life. So I cannot wait to be reminded of that again. So thanks so much for having me on.
Well, let's all meet again here around a bowl of Taylor Wrap.
Oh, thank you. Please.
Whew. Well, that was a fun couple of months.
It was.
We ate a lot of ramen.
It went longer than we anticipated because of the fact that we missed 2 weeks due to being snowed in.
Yeah, we weren't anticipating that at all.
No, and we went from being snowed in to it being almost 80 degrees in Seattle somehow. Took us right into the actual start of spring. And spring and subsequently summer mean another bracket. A longer search that will feature many more than 8 locations. And as we've talked about on the pod, including as recently as last week, we're searching for Seattle's best sandwich.
Mm, fired up! I think I get sick of the brackets right when we reach the end of them and get really excited about the next one.
Are you fired up about the actual bracket or whether a hot dog qualifies as a sandwich?
I'm fired up about both because a hot dog does not qualify as a sandwich.
Oh,
it's, okay. We're not doing the hot dog thing, right?
Why not?
We can talk about a Costco hot dog, but if we're going to actually search for Seattle's best hot dog, that deserves its own bracket and search.
I suppose.
Not being pigeonholed within the sandwich bracket. In the same way that a burger, if by whatever technical definition you want to use, a burger's probably a sandwich,
yes.
But a burger gets its own bracket. And a hot dog gets its own bracket, too.
So you're promising a hot dog? I just don't know. How many hot dog places are there? You're going to review
every street corner at 2 a.m.?
No,
we're going to we have to get sufficiently drunk and then go to every street corner.
I don't know. I don't know about this
and plan. Costco.
I might be too old for this shit.
We're going to have to go outside of every sporting event in Seattle.
So we have not yet accumulated a list of sandwich places. A few people have shared their suggestions with us on Twitter.
Have they?
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't seen this at all.
And you should definitely continue to do so.
What do we have so far?
I
love hearing about sandwiches.
I know tats was suggested to us, which we already...
You best believe we're going to be eating tats.
No. Actually, I'm sorry. It wasn't tats. It was tubs is what I'm saying.
Oh, tubs. I've never had tubs before.
Which I mentioned
that... But we're going to be eating both.
I mentioned that we were going to do because it's located near Aloha Ramen on Lake City Way. You have to pass tubs to get to Aloha, at least the way that I went. So, or if you're going from I-5, which most people probably would. So I mentioned it then. That will definitely be on the list. I think there was one other suggestion that I was not as familiar with, but... Grinders on Aurora near the Shoreline Costco, which is pretty deep.
Grinders on Aurora?
Yeah.
Huh, because there's a Grinders place in Fremont.
I don't know if that's the same place. I guess we'll have to do some research.
I'm sure it's a different place, right behind the Lenin statue.
So we definitely have, you know, some places in mind. Would love, again, your suggestions. But next week, I think we're going to start with a place that was once a PeltonCast favorite, went away. And now is returning to us.
There we go.
And that's Ferrale, which was located in South Park, right near the Crispy Crunchy Chicken.
We love a food inside a gas station.
That was more of a convenience store.
Okay, yeah, we love a food in a convenience store in South Park, though.
We really do. Surprisingly so. But shut down in that particular location. The owner talked to our mom, of all people, about this.
Mm-hmm. So we had some inside info. She brought it back, I have to say.
And is now reopening as a truck. On Saturday, they're going to be having a grand opening just outside of, and why am I now blanking on the name?
Bar Ciudad.
Yeah, Bar Ciudad in Georgetown with live music. It sounds like it's going to be quite an event.
Wow, that's a lot of fanfare for the Ferrale truck coming back.
It is. It's starting at 3 p.m. on Saturday, I believe, running all the way until 10 p.m.
And we're going to eat some delicious crema.
So we'll start out by reviewing that one, a place that we've been to in the past and have enjoyed, and so are excited about its return.
A good thing about doing the search for rather than a bracket is we don't have to decide going in.
No.
So you can keep firing sandwich places at us throughout the next 4 months or however long we're going to be doing this.
Yep. I think we've got about that period of time.
Oh, my God. Oh, I'm so excited to eat all these sandwiches.
Also, giveaways, pinatas, and an assorted variety of spirits and cocktails at this event.
There we go.
So,
well,
I'm excited.
Well, thanks to Marcus also.
Yeah. Third Pelton brother. Anything else on the sandwich?
Like a third Talking Taco Time brother.
I still consider that third Pelton brother. I mean, they're on the Pelton cast feed, among other things. Anything else to get to on sandwiches? All right, you spent last week in Austin, Texas, which, as you mentioned earlier, did you eat anything notable in Austin?
So, my trip to Austin, food-wise, is more about my failures than anything else.
Wow.
Which, granted, I was busy doing things, and I would say that I ate incredibly well, right? I ate a lot of very good meals, but there are a couple of places that I'd circled on the map.
Yeah.
I was staying about a block away from two of sort of the hottest food spots in Austin. And do you know how much of that food I ate?
I'm going to guess none based on
zero.
That.
Zero of it.
One of these was La Barbecue, right?
La Barbecue and Veracruz All Natural Tacos. Veracruz I've had numerous times before. I didn't need to have that, right? But at the same time, they're probably the best tacos I've ever had. La Barbecue, I've never had before. Cousin Two, a barbecue place in Charleston.
Lewis Barbecue, which I told you was the best barbecue I've ever had and one of the best meals I've ever had. John Lewis, the former pitmaster at La Barbecue.
And I somehow didn't make it there. I mean, I had excellent
barbecue. You can't tell. The listener can't tell, but I'm shaking my head disapprovingly.
You're very disappointed. I had crocodile bacon at Willie Nelson's Ranch.
All right, that sounds pretty good.
It was pretty good. My favorite thing about it was I talked so much with the person who was making the food, who was catering, that when they had the crocodile bacon, he specifically went and found me and was like, did you try this? Nice. And I feel like that's the reputation that I want to have wherever I go.
Hashtag brand.
Yes. But
do you want to explain why you were at Willie Nelson's Ranch?
And one of the bands that I work with was playing at a music festival at Willie Nelson's Ranch. It was pretty incredible. I don't know if I want to get into Willie Nelson's Ranch because we're talking about food here.
Yes.
And the food was good, but there was nothing that notable.
We'll save that for our Willie Nelson's Ranch podcast.
Yeah. Ranch Bros. We also talk about Taco Time Ranch.
I was going to call it Big Willie style.
Oh, that's actually not bad. But yeah, there was really nothing else where it was like, oh yes, this is a life-changing meal that I had. I did, however, have ramen in Austin.
Did you?
I had what was pretty widely considered to be maybe the only ramen place in Austin. Definitely the premier ramen in Austin.
I mean, ramen, even though Austin is obviously not known for ramen, it's so trendy and hip that I've got to assume they have multiple ramen spots.
I don't know. You should look at Yelp. There's not a lot. Look at Yelp and tell me which place I went to. I bet you'll find it within 1 second. And I don't think you could do that with most cities. Okay, which ramen do you think that I went to in Austin? You have one guess.
All right, the first two locations that come up are Ramen Tatsuya.
Yeah, so I went to Ramen Tatsuya.
There are other ones on here, though.
I'm just saying, like, it's so evident from that.
And just like in Seattle, they're all rated 4 stars.
I thought the ramen was pretty good. I ordered extra noodles because I saw extra noodles on the menu and I was like, I'm going for that. The people I was with sort of like were explaining to me like about the different ramens and I was like, I'm currently doing a ramen bracket. It's like, I'm pretty confident going into this ramen ordering experience.
You were getting ramen explained?
I mean, it makes sense. Like, you know, you don't know necessarily how much ramen people have had. I don't know what a person's... People don't wear their ramen credentials on their sleeve. You have to ask them.
That'd be really weird if they did. 2 months ago, you might have actually needed that explanation, as it turns out. But thankfully, we have done this bracket, and you now know.
I mean, like, if you asked me the difference between, like, types of ramen, like, I could probably tell you taste-wise. I don't know if I could, like, confidently explain them, though. But I can confidently explain very little.
Can you confidently explain sports?
Depends on the sport.
Okay. You're going to do some confident explaining later.
Oh, yeah. I don't know what, but the Seahawks offseason, I've got some thoughts. I really wanted to get into it with Zach there.
Well, there's a return of a segment that requires more confidence than it necessarily does knowledge.
So that place was good. Honestly, the extra noodles was a little bit much, where it was like, I was kind of swimming in noodles at some point, and it was just like a sort of hot day, and I'd been drinking like Lone Stars all day.
Yeah, this is part of why Austin is probably not known for ramen, that there's a season for ramen, hashtag ramen season, which we already have moved out of in Seattle, at least temporarily.
It poured rain that night, though.
Oh, okay. There's not a ramen season in Austin.
But it was just like, good God, this is a lot of noodles. Huh. I thought it was good, though.
What type of ramen did you actually order?
It was a spicy ramen.
Okay.
But I thought it was good. All right. It probably wouldn't have been a competitor for the best ramen in Seattle.
Anything else on Austin food?
I wish that I had more.
What's the...
It feels like I was alone for a night in Charleston and just stayed in my hotel room.
Oh, jeez. How disappointing. How many Lone Stars did you consume over the course of your time in Austin?
I mean, an uncountable amount.
It was like the stars in the sky, the number of Lone Stars you consume. It's like grains of sand on the beach.
Yes. I mean, there was one night, I actually...
Because I'm assuming it's a finite number that you had.
It was a range. I have a coworker who's known to be able to drink so much beer without being affected at all. And I saw him at a show at like midnight or whatever. And I was like, how many beers have you had today? And he's like, probably 12. And then we went and got late night breakfast burritos, like 2 a.m. breakfast burritos, which, by the way,
always a good play.
Amazing.
Except when it's not.
No, it's always a good play. And he was there at this, like, all alone at this, like, little, like, corner Mexican restaurant. And he had 2 Dos Equis sitting in front of him. And then, like, the group of people that I was with showed up. And it was, like, they were right about to close or, like, shut down the bar. And he ordered 2 more Dos Equis. He probably had 16 beers that day.
That was a total of 4 Equis.
But I drank almost exclusively Lone Star when I could, and I probably had, I don't know, 50 plus.
Nice.
Throughout the week. It's what's there, and you kind of find yourself just drinking all day, you know?
Yep.
So that was pretty cool.
All right. Well, should we get into sports?
Well, the other thing, one last thing that I want to say.
Okay.
Is here's my argument for myself, right? If I were confronted with why I didn't eat these notable items, is A, like, you're busy with stuff, right? There's a lot happening. But B, the replacement level of tacos is extremely high in Austin.
Makes sense.
I had gone to New York, and I think somebody had described to me in the past that, like, the replacement level of pizza in New York is extremely high.
Did they use that phrase, or was that my interpretation of that phrase?
No, nobody has ever actually used that phrase, only you and Nate Duncan. But...
No, Nate Silver has definitely used that phrase. Replacement level of
pizza.
You.
Like, dollar pizza on the street in New York is kind of crappy pizza. Like, I'm sorry, but it's no better than just crappy pizza in Seattle. However,
I've not had it on the street, so I don't know. I can't say either way.
Like, cheap tacos from a taco truck in Austin are exponentially better than the average taco you would get at a taco truck in Seattle. So, Vera Cruz was like maybe three blocks away. There was a taco truck that was directly across the street that had no line ever. So for me, I would rather get the taco that is maybe 80% as good, but I don't have to wait in the line. Not always, but I've already had Vera Cruz, right? Yes. Like, I don't need to try those for the first time. My taste buds have already been blessed by Vera Cruz All Natural. So being able to go to a taco truck that I can just go and get my fix for a taco immediately, like, that's kind of, I think, the choice that I made.
I did learn from Mallory Rubin on House of Carbs, as she was describing her South By experience, that you could have postmated from Vera Cruz.
Wait, really?
Yeah. So keep that in mind for 2020.
Okay. All right. Law Barbecue is the one that I pine for, though. And I had so much excellent barbecue throughout the week. That, and also Salt Lick in the airport, which, best meal of any trip to Austin is always the Salt Lick in the airport.
Man, eating that before getting on a plane for 4.5 hours, that's a risky play.
I ate a Salt Lick beef brisket sandwich, chopped beef sandwich, and a Lone Star in the airport. It was a good flight.
Okay.
Yeah, 10 Things I Hate About You has never been better.
All right, now should we get to sports?
All right.
We start with a quick construction update. The NHL Seattle group on Tuesday posted a video showing most of the seats cleared from Key Arena in preparation for the, quote, hard demolition portion of the rebuild, which is scheduled to begin in late April or early May. As I noted on Twitter, kind of interesting timing, because in an alternate scenario where this rebuild was not happening, the Key Arena would be preparing right now to be hosting first and second round action in the NCAA men's basketball tournament on Friday and Sunday. So, very different instead. In the NCAA tournament scheduled to return after the new arena is complete. All right, I think that brings us to the triumphant return of your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Well, I don't know if you saw this story, but the Mariners are playing regular season games in Japan this week. And Ichiro is going to be part of the active roster. And you know what I think about that. I love it!
I wasn't sure which way this was going to go.
If this team is going to be bad, they might as well be interesting. But why stop with Ichiro? I want him to go full-on homer at the bat with this season. You know what'll put butts in seats? Ken Griffey Jr. plays a weekend series. Edgar at DH to commemorate his Hall of Fame induction. Is that a Luis Soho sighting? Count me in. Imagine this. A 90s night, and you don't know which Mariners 90s pitcher is pitching. Could it be Randy? Jamie? Uh-oh. You got George Glynatsis. They can't all be winners. You can take the show on the road, too. Road trip to San Francisco? See Barry Bonds one last time. Pete Rose? Is he still able to play? The ghost of Mordecai Three Fingers Brown? This Mariners season will have it all. I think Ozzie Smith summed it up right in that episode. This Mariners season when he said, a bottomless pit? I have gotta see that.
Wow. You know, it's obviously early. The season hasn't even started. That's going to be hard to top is the hottest take, the best hot take of 2019.
You didn't know Mordecai Three Fingers Brown was getting into it?
I did not. I mean, I still think George Glanatsis was the most improbable reference in there, who played like pitched two games for the Mariners, I believe.
They were a notable two games for 9-year-old Tristan.
They were very notable two games. I once tweeted with Bob Condona about it, who covered a George Glanatsis start.
Well, there you go. Dropping again.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Mariners, in fact, by the time you listen to this, will almost certainly have begun their season. They play the Oakland Athletics in Japan on Wednesday at 2:35 a.m. Pacific time, again on Thursday at 2:35 a.m. Pacific time. I heard from a friend earlier who said that he was going to get up in time for the game. I will not be. I will be hopefully soundly sleeping at that point. I once stayed up for the Sonics when they opened the season in Japan, the 2003-04 season. I tried to go into the Sonics office to watch the game as an intern at that point. And then
you're lucky you're hired for full-time employment.
Very. look at the dedication I was showing. I know.
This creep is trying to show up at 3 a.m.
There was no one there, of course. Also, like, this was 2003, so there was no, like, Twitter or recap after the game. Like, we were just, like, letting the game happen. But then it was blacked out. I got all the way down to the Sonics office.
Wait, really?
And it was blacked out, and I had to go back to where I was living at that point and listen to it on the radio at 3 in the morning.
Oh, my God.
Thankfully, they played the second of those two games. It was a day game on Saturday in Japan. It was Friday night Seattle time. That was a much better setup, and that was the game where Rashard Lewis scored 50 points.
There you go.
So there's your Sonic history for the day.
Big in Japan.
I can't believe Ichiro's on the roster. Like, it's the best. He's starting. It's
so does this push back his Hall of Fame induction? That's what I was wondering about. So he's technically not retired.
No, he's not retired.
Yeah. I mean, it's not an issue for Barry Bonds, though, when you think about it.
Let's be clear. He's not going to retire even after the Mariners wave him at some point.
You just have to be retired from Major League Baseball, right? He could still be playing in Japan 5 years later.
Apparently has no interest in playing in Japan. I don't know. What's going to happen with Ichiro is one of the great mysteries of the 2019 Mariners season, almost as much as what's going to happen with Felix. Good times. Anything else on the Mariners?
That was more than enough.
It really was.
I like that we talked about the Sonics during the Mariners segment.
Of course. The Sounders ran their record to an MLS best 3-0 with a 4-2 win Saturday in their first road game against the Chicago Fire. Match saw the Sounders take a 3-0 lead just after halftime, then concede twice in the second half before sealing the match with a late Ruy Diaz goal. It's his eighth consecutive match with a goal dating back to last season. A Sounders franchise record. Also saw the third goal of the young season for Jordan Morris, who will, along with Christian Roldan, be joining the U.S. men's national team now for friendlies versus Ecuador and Chile as the MLS breaks for international play. The Sounders have started 3-0 for the first time since 2009, their inaugural season we talked about earlier. They are the only MLS team with a perfect win, 3-0 record, and lead MLS with 10 goals, tied for first with a +7 goal differential. This team's rolling.
All right.
Kind of almost hate to see the international break because they're playing so well. Not that, you know, it should affect things too much.
Did you watch this game?
No, I did not because I was waiting in line and then eating
ordering sushi.
Yeah. I tried to stream it, but was unable to stream it.
It was blacked out.
Yeah. No, the Wi-Fi was not that strong outside of Tsukishinba, sadly.
I mean, starting out 3-0, like...
You literally can't do any better than that.
It almost makes you nervous, though.
Does it?
Yeah.
That it's going to be the opposite of every other Sounders season, that they'll start really well and then do poorly in the second half?
Yeah.
I prefer to think about it, like, what if they get better in the second half still?
Whoa.
Well, mind blown.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's safe to say that the Sounders are not going to lose a game.
Yes. The perfect season on tap.
Mm-hmm.
That would set a record.
All wins, too. No ties.
Yep. Obviously. So we talked a little bit about the Seahawks with Zach Whitman, but let's get into more depth about their activity during the first week of free agency, which officially began on Wednesday after the previous 2 days of the legal tampering period. And the Seahawks, unlike when we recorded last Monday, have actually signed some players to replace some of the players they have lost. Mostly their own players re-signing. Re-signed guard DJ Fluker to a 2-year deal worth a base of $6 million and a max of $9 million. linebacker Michael Kendricks to a one-year deal with a base value of $4.5 million and a max value of $5.5 million, although no guaranteed money, notably, in that deal, in case he's unable to play after his sentencing on insider trading. And then, somewhat surprisingly, after re-signing Kendricks, also re-signed K.J. Wright to a two-year contract worth up to $15 million that is Wright himself explained in an appearance on KJR. Is basically, it's a one-year deal for $8 million with a $7 million option the next year because his 2020 base salary is completely non-guaranteed.
So if he plays poorly, gets injured, whatever, he'll be released.
Yeah, it'll be a one-year deal at that point, and the Seahawks would have a $2.5 million dead cap that they would take if they released him after the season, as opposed to a $9.5 million cap hit for him if they keep him on the roster. The Seahawks did sign a couple of players from other teams. So after losing J.R. Sweezy to the Arizona Cardinals, they went out and replaced him with the player that J.R. Sweezy is replacing in Arizona, Mike Iupati, signed to a much cheaper deal than Sweezy, a one-year deal worth a minimum of $2.25 million with an additional $500,000 in roster bonuses and $500,000 in playtime bonuses. And then Jason Myers signed to that deal we discussed with Zach, 4 years, $15.5 million, $5.5 million guaranteed at signing, only the signing bonus in his 2019 base salary guaranteed at the time he signs. So takeaways from this activity from the Seahawks.
Do you want the negative version or the positive version?
Let's start with the negative version.
Well, the negative version focuses almost exclusively on Jason Myers, which is this is another situation where the Seahawks had a weakness one season and overcorrected, but didn't overcorrect smart, right?
They very rarely do when they overcorrect, unless you think that drafting Rashad Penny in the first round was a good decision.
The names of a couple of overcorrections for you from back in the day.
Okay.
Michael Bennett, Cliff Avril. Those were overcorrections to not having pass rush against Atlanta.
Yes, that's
in right. That NFC divisional game that were excellent decisions and were on team-friendly contracts.
Yes. The market that year, for some reason, did not realize that those were two of the best pass rushers in the NFL.
It is an interesting thing to kind of look at how the NFL free agency market fluctuates, because last year, nobody cared about safeties.
Yep.
This year, everybody cares about safeties.
Yeah.
It's like, what happened? So you really can't expect markets to continue, I think, aside from, like, everybody knows that quarterbacks are going to be expensive.
And that running backs are likely going to continue to stay lower in value relative to other skill positions.
I think it's a little hard to predict exactly how sort of positional markets will fluctuate year to year. But this is an overcorrection because the kicking was, let's say, below average last season with Seabass. And it's an overcorrection in, I don't want to say the most obvious way, but a way that is not replicable, right? So what they did with Rashad Penny last year was they went out and spent a first-round draft pick on a running back, and we know that running backs are, their success is based on five other factors aside from running back ability. With this is a kicker who had an excellent season last year, but we know that kicking is mostly random from year to year. When you look at the facts, as Zach alluded to, that Jason Myers was not considered good enough to keep at training camp last year, or at least beat Sebastian Janikowski out for a job.
Oh, but that they guaranteed like $600,000 of Sebastian Janikowski's contract. So how could they ever have eaten that?
You think that's why they made that decision? Or do they just think that they were the same quality of player? Like a year ago, I think they realized that they were probably the same quality of player because most kickers are the same quality of kicker.
All right, can I make a pro Jason Myers case?
Okay.
The one thing I will defend them on is at least Jason Myers appears to be good at kickoffs.
Okay.
Like the Jets scored really highly in that in addition to place kicking last season.
I'm not down on this Jason Myers signing either. Like,
I'm pretty down on it because...
But he doesn't cost them a comp pick, right?
No, he does.
Oh, I thought he didn't.
No.
Why? Are you sure?
Well, he doesn't cost them a comp pick, but I mean, he counts against their comp pick.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I thought Jason Myers didn't count against them.
I mean, they. So we'll get into comp picks a little More detail. I've got lots. But they have lost 6 qualifying players and have signed 2 at this point. So you're only eligible for a maximum of 4. But they would potentially be able to get a higher one because of the fact that Myers is canceling out a higher paid player than they're currently getting a comp pick for now.
I thought I read that wrong.
That makes sense.
Okay, so here's the positive. Do you want the positive version?
What?
This is pretty much the perfect offseason. Like, if you were to
I wanted to keep going on the Jason Myers.
Let's come back to Jason Myers in a second. Well, no, let's do that now because we were just talking about him.
I mean, like, it's weird because their process was actually really good last year. Like, they realized that kicking is random, and Jason Myers was coming off a couple of disappointing seasons in Jacksonville, but was likely to improve compared to that. And they signed him to a bargain. It was a futures contract, I believe, when they signed him this time, like, or even before free agency this time a year ago. And if they would have just stuck with that, it would have been great. But then they signed Janikowski. And, like, nothing Jason Myers did last year should change your perception of him to go from futures contract to one of the 10 highest paid kickers in the NFL right now.
Yeah.
And I know everyone is very excited about the structure of this contract, but okay, if you release him after this season, you'll still take a $3 million cap hit in 2019 from the signing bonus, or 2020.
They likely will not release him after the season.
And B, then you'll have paid Jason Myers $5.5 million to kick for you for 1 year. So yes, like, you can get out of it without too much pain, but if you do that, it's still a terrible contract. And this is a weird example of, like, fans internalize the team narratives of, well, it's a low-risk deal, and fans don't actually think about what that means. They just repeat it ad nauseum.
Yeah.
This is, I mean, there's still a degree of risk to it, even if it's not necessarily, like, it's also such a bad contract that they have to keep him.
You could just draft a kicker.
They should have drafted a kicker. That's what I've been advocating all along. They might have been more likely to draft a kicker.
You're mad that your bold prediction is not going to come through.
They might.
I've seen you with your NBA predictions.
Yeah, that's a different thing. They might have been more willing to draft a kicker if they had more than 4 draft picks this year, which is another case of them kind of like doubling down on their mistakes.
Okay, so
compounding them.
So then, can I talk about why this is the perfect offseason?
All right,
because what they needed to do this offseason, there's no. The team isn't perfect, but there's no glaring weakness that they needed to address in free agency to me.
That's probably true.
And they lost J.R. Sweezy, and they replaced him with, like, a probably compatible player in Mike Iupati.
I'd say Iupati's probably slightly worse.
But at the time, pedigree-wise, Mike Iupati was considered a very good offensive lineman.
Back in the day, I mean, he's had a lot of injuries since then. It's been a while.
But also, there's the Seahawks, I'm going to knock on wood, giant knock on wood when I say this, have quite a bit of depth on offensive line at this point.
I mean, my hot take is that I think that Jordan Simmons will end up starting at guard.
There are a lot of options. I mean, there's Jordan Simmons, there's Posick, there's Fant, then there's Iupati. Like, there are options.
I don't know if I would say Fant is an option at guard, unless you're kicking in Fetty inside somehow.
That could happen too. I mean, there are options unlikely. For things that could happen here. There are offensive linemen on the roster who have experience playing offensive line.
Yeah, I mean, I think you mostly just needed to have, like, 3 competent guards. And in Fluker, Iupati, and Simmons, I think they have 3 competent guards.
And they have Posick.
Sure.
Who is a football player. So that signing, I'm totally fine. It's such a low-risk signing. And again, the comp pick value, if it is a comp pick, it's a 7th-round comp pick.
So Iupati is... The reason I like the offseason so much is because of the fact that you're getting to this point.
Yes. The thing that they needed to do this offseason, the overcorrection that we wanted, was they went into these last 2 drafts with very little draft capital, and they needed to build up the draft capital again. This team, if Pete Carroll wants to coach until he's 85 years old, he needs to start building up draft capital again and get more talent on the roster from young players, yeah. Right? And that is not going to happen this offseason, right? Like, no matter what they trade down from their first round pick for when they do that, it's still not going to be enough. Next year, if they go into that draft with 10 draft picks or more, they're going to really be able to build up the depth. They're going to be able to build the next generation of the Seahawks next draft, and it's going to be because of this offseason.
So it's unclear if Iupati counts against the comp pick formula because of the fact that the final year of his contract was voided by the Cardinals. They didn't technically release him, in which case he clearly would not be eligible. But also, it wasn't just like his contract ended, in which case he clearly would be eligible. So I don't know when we'll find that out. Yeah. Currently,
what type of football gods have to comment on that?
I would not call Roger Goodell a football god, or the NFL league office in general. Nick Corte of OverTheCap.com, who does the best job kind of analyzing this, is counting Iupati and still has the Seahawks getting the maximum 4 comp picks. A 3rd rounder for Earl Thomas. We'll talk more about that in a second. A 4th rounder for Justin Coleman. A 6th rounder for Shamar Stephen. A 7th rounder for Brett Hundley. And
did Brett Hundley sign somewhere?
He did. He signed with the Cardinals as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. You missed Seahawks Twitter freaking out about the Seahawks trading a 6th round pick for Brett Hundley. That was quite a moment.
Last year?
No. I mean, they were freaking out when he signed with the Cardinals. Flooding Bob Gondonis mentions with tweets about this.
Wait, I don't understand.
They were upset that they gave up a pick for Hundley only to see him leave after the year.
He still played on the team for a year.
That's irrelevant. He didn't play in any games, so therefore there was no value to him.
We should be thanking the Lord that he didn't play in any games.
So if Iupati doesn't count, the Seahawks would still only get a 7th round pick from Mike Davis, who Iupati is currently canceling out, but it would be more likely they get the pick because of the possibility that they're more than the maximum 32 qualifying compensatory picks. So, you know, right now, Hundley is at the very bottom of that list.
Sure.
So it would be good if Iupati. And then the other thing is it would allow them to sign another qualifying free agent without losing one of those picks altogether.
Okay. But they shouldn't.
Probably not.
Don't sign any qualifying free agents. They're worthless.
So they did get a visit from a qualifying free agent, that being rush end Aaron Lynch, who had 3 sacks last season for the Chicago Bears. It has a history of playing 3-4 outside linebacker, most prominently for Vic Fangio, who was his defensive coordinator last year with the Bears, and as well as his rookie season during the 49ers. And it was still kind of a Fangio scheme that they were playing after that, when Lynch was actually effective during his first 2 NFL seasons before dealing with a number of injuries. The Seahawks are clearly trying to add some pass rush after that being a weakness of theirs, and with Deion Jordan a free agent, but Aaron Lynch does not seem to me to be the guy.
How long does it last? Like, is there a point where players stop counting as compensatory picks?
Yes, later in the offseason they do. I don't know that date
Okay.
off the top of my head.
Well, let's just mark that on the Seahawks calendar.
But you can also sign players who got cut, including the other player who has reportedly visited the Seahawks.
Here we go.
That being wide receiver Jordy Nelson, who was released by the Oakland Raiders after a 63 catch for 739 yards and 3 touchdowns season.
A not bad season. Considering Derek Carr was passing him the ball?
Yeah. So here's my hot take. Like, literally everyone on Seahawks Twitter tweeted the same joke. It was the overworked Seahawks Twitter joke of the week, that he is the new insert wide receiver here who got cut before the end of the season. What did we decide that we were naming this group?
Which version? Who are going to get cut at the end of training camp?
No,
Cut
during the season.
I think you named it the Breland Edwards Memorial.
That sounds right. Brandon Marshall obviously was the first nomination here because of the fact that he was more recent. But to me, you go with the earliest possible candidate, not the most recent one. But I think that Jordy Nelson is better than that. I mean, in terms of DVOA, he was Oakland's best receiver who saw appreciable playing time last year, caught 72% of his passes in the very ultra-conservative Derek Carr offense. Yes, he turns 34 in May, so that's the downside here, but I don't think he's quite as washed as the guys that we're talking about with the Seahawks.
Yeah, I like it. Sign Jordy Nelson. If it's low money, why not?
Yeah, I don't really have any downside to it. Do you want to talk about the other categories of players?
Okay, so we talked through this, right? You have your Brandon Marshall, Breland Edwards category, which granted, Breland Edwards had some huge catches. Brandon Marshall, I don't know if we could say as much.
No.
Which are veteran wide receivers who sign with the Seahawks and then are released sort of midway through the season.
You could even expand it to include the cornerback from the Eagles who replaced Byron Maxwell.
Cornerback from the Eagles? I don't remember that one.
He started at the beginning of the season and then got cut midway through the
year.
Was
this last year?
No, not last year. This is no. This is when Byron Maxwell signed the giant contract with the Eagles.
I think you're thinking of Antoine Wingfield.
No, Antoine Wingfield was different. He didn't make the team out of
exactly.
Training.
Antoine Wingfield is the second category of player who is alongside.
I believe his name is Winfield. Are you putting a G in there?
It's Winfield, not Wingfield.
Yeah.
Oh,
you're thinking of D'Antonio Wingfield, namesake of the D'Antonio Wingcast, a reference that only Zach of all the listener will get.
So that's the second category, which are veterans who are released at the end of training camp and subsequently retire. So you've got your Terrell Owens. Because to me, I think he was the first one ever, right?
I mean, I don't know about ever, but yes, he was probably the first recent
one. Oh, I've got one. Oh, my God. This was Pete's first year. What was the Lendale White?
Yeah, that's a pretty good one.
Right? I think that was the end of training camp.
Kerry Williams is who I'm thinking of.
Kerry Williams. But Lendale, they signed and released before the season started, right?
I would assume so. I mean, all of these players run together at some point.
I think he might be the first one in Pete Carroll history. Well, Pete Carroll Seahawks history, who they signed, a veteran that they signed, and then released before the season started. So
he did not make the roster.
Lendale White, Terrell Owens.
Fun fact, the Seahawks actually did not sign Lendale White. They acquired him in a draft day trade with the Titans.
There we go.
That also netted Anthony McCoy and Walter Thurmond.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Those were some players. What did they trade for?
Altron Werner went to Tennessee's directions. I mean, these were all draft picks.
Yeah, Altron Werner was pretty good too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So there's that category. But then the third category, my favorite one, which are veterans. You're going way back to Jerry Rice for this one. Veterans who never were released, but played at the end of the season with the Seahawks, and then subsequently, Jerry Rice didn't even retire. He played more after that.
Did he?
I think the Raiders' tenure was after the Seahawks.
No, the Raiders' tenure was before that. I'm pretty sure that was the end of
camp with somebody else after.
He might have gone to camp with somebody. He definitely did.
Jerry Rice didn't retire in the same way that Devin Hester retired.
Yeah, Devin Hester is the other classic example here. Another one, Brandon Stokely.
Brandon Stokely?
I don't know for sure that he retired, because I was wondering whether he came up at one point when I was thinking about this. There's all definitely. I mean, the Seahawks have types, and Jordy Nelson fits their type, but hopefully he's a more effective version of their type. Now, I guess Stokely played several more years, but Jerry Rice started the playoff game for the Seahawks.
I think
he did not have a catch against the Rams in that game, which the Seahawks lost at home in the playoffs.
So here's you talking about Jordy Nelson. Every year, the Seahawks trick themselves into thinking that one of these veteran players are going to be the one that will be able to play for them for the entire season. But Jordy Nelson, I think he's the one.
I mean, look, he's got better advanced stats.
That's you. No, sign Jordy. Whatever. Who cares?
So we haven't talked about the fact that Earl Thomas signed with the Baltimore Ravens.
It's funny because Richard Sherman got an entire emergency pod when he signed with the 49ers, but maybe we've dealt with loss.
We definitely have. Like, we knew when he got injured against the Cardinals, and has now acknowledged, flipped off Pete Carroll.
Now that he's not on the team anymore.
By the way, I'm not sure if Pete Carroll is the right person to blame here. I don't know if
I know.
It's tough to apportion. Blame may not necessarily be the right word here.
We've talked so extensively about this, but the salary cap is who you should have been flipping off.
Yeah. I mean, look, the Seahawks could have made room for Earl Thomas if they wanted to. I mean,
clearly the Ravens did.
They're not paying. Earl Thomas is not going to make that much. Obviously, it's a much longer contract, but Earl Thomas is not going to make that much more than KJ Wright.
How shocked are we about this contract?
I'm not shocked. I mean, I was worried on Earl Thomas's behalf about the market because of what happened to safeties last year. But as you mentioned, it's a totally different market this year.
No, when we saw the first couple of signings, it was clear to me that Earl was going to get a pretty good deal. I think this one exceeded my expectations.
I think so, too. Yeah, especially in terms of, like, the length.
But also, Earl's really fucking good.
Yeah, I mean,
he's Earl Thomas.
He's maybe the greatest, like, center field coverage safety in NFL history. I don't think that's hyperbole.
Is Earl Thomas a Hall of Famer?
Oh, yeah.
Unquestionably, right?
Yeah.
I mean Earl Thomas was potentially the best defensive player on a team that won a Super Bowl and went to another Super Bowl?
I think he was, yes.
Do we have any sort of reservations about where he went?
No.
It's pretty much the perfect team.
In the AFC.
Right? Are the Ravens playing here next year?
Yes.
Oh, man.
So that'll be fun.
I'm excited for that. I can't wait for the takes on whether to boo Earl Thomas or not.
Oh,
start working out your takes now.
Always my favorite. I am surprised that Earl Thomas, I guess he has made some All-Pro teams, but not the AP All-Pro teams since 2014. Or no, I guess he was second team in 2017. Pay no attention to me. He's very good. He's going to make the Hall of Fame, yes.
He's playing on a defense that's a fun defense too, right? Like Earl Thomas being part of the... like 49ers defense, like it would have been interesting for him and Richard Sherman to play together again.
And by interesting, you mean probably sad.
Well, yes. But the idea of him playing with the Ravens, like I think there's a chance that he plays at a high level. I think there's a chance that he's playing on one of the best defenses in the league and that Earl Thomas could really excel there.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the only question here is if he can stay healthy. I mean, that's been the issue. When he's been on the field, he has still played at an extremely high level.
So it's cool to see that the Ravens recognizing the kind of talent that Earl has and just how well he was playing last season. Like, this isn't a situation where his play had fallen off and, they're not getting, like, sad Earl Thomas.
Yeah.
He was great. He was the best player on the Seahawks defense, maybe aside from Bobby Wagner. He was, at the very least, the second best player on the Seahawks defense when he was on the field last year.
Yeah.
And had a shocking and horrible injury, and we hope that he recovers from it and plays very well for the Ravens.
In 15 games.
And then he can play well against the Seahawks, too. That's fine.
They would just hope the Seahawks avoid the middle of the field, other teams did against the Seahawks for many, many years.
Do we have favorite Earl Thomas memories?
I mean, the hit on Gronk in the Patriots game is probably got to be high up there.
I feel like Earl doesn't have the same kind of like Cam Chancellor has like so many notable plays.
Yes.
Earl has like a lot of playing at a high level, but no one play where I'm like, whoa, that. It was just a lot of him like, are we forgetting something?
Did he intercept the pass on the play where he got, and where he broke his leg the first time against Carolina?
I don't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember for sure off the top of my head. I mean, you know, part of this is we haven't been primed for it. I mean, there were a lot of amazing interceptions, obviously.
That's the thing about Earl Thomas is the thing that you remember most is him covering so much ground.
But also, and I mean, this is to an extent like Richard Sherman and cornerbacks, like the greatest play is the fact that the plays that didn't happen because of the fact that teams never threw deep against the Seahawks when Earl Thomas was there in center field. And like you take that away, it suddenly becomes much easier to defend the rest of the field. Mm-hmm. It's all the times that teams were unable to pick on the cornerback opposite Richard Sherman when that player was not nearly as good as him. Like all sorts of things like that.
It's a sad day. Well, I feel like Earl Thomas kind of was this era of the Seahawks. He was the second player, I suppose, that Pete and John drafted after Russell Okung, but he was the one that was around for longer, had the most impact. He was the one who kind of changed this defense, and he was a rock for the Seahawks for a long time.
Also, one of the most amazing trades in Seahawks history. I'd have to go look up who the general manager was at this point. I don't know if it was still Tim Ruskell, but trading a second-round pick in 2009 for Denver's first round pick in 2010 that ended up becoming Earl Thomas.
God, who did Denver want in that
transaction?
Draft?
Oh, it was like, I believe it was a cornerback. I believe it's something like Alfonso Smith or something.
And oh, they got that cut. Who wanted Alfonso Smith?
He got cut the next year. He lasted 2 years in the league or something. It's one of the most amazing trades that has ever happened. And it's good to be on the right side of those kinds of trades. Yes, it was, in fact, Alfonso Smith.
There we go.
Who lasted one season.
Wow.
With the Broncos.
One season? He was a first-round draft pick? Yep. Or he was a second-round draft pick?
Second-round draft pick. High second-round draft pick.
And he lasted 1 year?
Yep.
Wow. Or they gave up the pick that became Earl Thomas.
That was Tim Ruskell. So,
well, you know what? A toast to Tim Ruskell. Yeah. There we go.
Not always great, but that one worked out quite well.
That was like drafting Brian Anger over Russell Wilson level decision there by the Broncos.
Yes, it was. But again, you know, you got to find the sucker at the table.
Yes.
Got to find the sucker at the table.
Sometimes the sucker at the table is trading high draft picks for Sheldon Richardson.
Do we have any new thoughts on Frank Clark after the D Ford trade? So the Chiefs got a second round pick from San Francisco for D Ford, who subsequently signed a contract that, even though it looks large on paper, guarantees him, I believe, less than $20 million.
Really?
It's basically just in 2019, his guaranteed money and the bonus. So
I didn't even know that trade happened. So
it didn't set the market as high for Frank Clark as it initially looked like it did, let's say.
Interesting.
But I don't feel like I would be willing to trade Frank Clark for just a second-round pick. And I'm not sure if that's a mistake because, again, the Seahawks traded a second-round pick for Sheldon Richardson and did turn out to be a terrible deal in hindsight.
I don't think it changes anything for me. I'm still firmly team they're going to re-sign Frank Clark. I don't believe that he's going to be traded. I think he's going to be re-signed before training camp.
You remain more optimistic on this front than I do. The other bit of Seahawks news is that they gave a second-round tender to George Fant as a restricted free agent. That was kind of necessary because you couldn't give Fant an original-round tender as an undrafted player. Teams would not have had to give up any compensation to sign him if the Seahawks were unwilling to match. So I think a reasonable decision, even though obviously it means a larger salary for Fant if he doesn't accept that one-year tender offer.
I mean, it shows that they really value George Fant, and they should.
Yep. All right, quickly on UW softball, a rough opening to Pac-12 play as they were swept at home by number one UCLA, outscored 22-8 in those three games, though most of that came in the third game where they were outscored 15-6 on Sunday. The Huskies dropped to number 8 in the ESPN poll and number 7 in the USA Today poll. Travel this upcoming weekend to face Oregon, which has started just 11-13 after the program basically imploded after the departure of their coach. Saw several key players transfer from a team that was one of the very best in the Pac-12 last season and no longer is.
Wow, fell all the way to number 8. Brutal.
All right, let's wrap up with more on UW men's basketball. We had the immediate reaction pod on Sunday to them being a number 9 seed and facing number 8 seed Utah State in the opening round, a game that we played this Friday at 3:50 p.m. Pacific time on TNT.
So you've had some time to think about this one, pore over the matchup. How are you feeling about it now as opposed to your initial reactions on Sunday?
I would say a bit more optimistic. So one thing that made me feel more optimistic, 538 came out with their NCAA tournament projections, and they have it as the second closest matchup of any in the first round.
Really?
Behind only VCU and Central Florida. I mean, that makes sense. It is an 8-9 matchup, but they actually rate the Huskies as the stronger team on paper. And the only reason Utah State is favored by 538 is because of the travel advantage that they factor in. Nationwide Arena in Columbus, where this game will be played, approximately 1,500 miles from Logan, Utah, approximately 2,000 miles from Seattle.
That does not feel like a difference to me.
It does make a difference, but it's pretty marginal.
That's interesting. I was expecting from 538 the dumpster fire gif.
I mean, so one reason they're a little bit different.
It also checks out, though. I mean, we saw the S-curve, basically, or the full ranking of where teams rated. And the Huskies in Utah State, the Huskies were the number 1 9 seed. Utah State was the number 4 8 seed.
Yeah.
Like, this should be a very close game.
So one reason this is closer in 538's model than KenPom's, which gives the Huskies a 42% chance of winning, is because of the fact that based on the past track record, 538 incorporates preseason AP polls into its projections. And of course, the Huskies were ranked in that, and Utah State was not, has not been ranked all season until the final poll after winning the Mountain West tournament. They cracked the top 25 this week.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, you remember what happened when the Huskies cracked the top 25.
I tried to. It didn't go super great.
So let's hope that the same fate happens to Utah State. But yeah, I mean, I guess hearing you say both because this is matchup-wise, this is the closest matchup in the entire NCAA tournament.
Yes.
Like, it could be closer. There's according no two
to the,
teams.
According to the selection committee.
But like, there are no two teams that are right next to each other.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that it would be one of the two closest matchups per 538.
Yeah.
So what about the matchup itself?
All right, so one interesting note before we get into this that I found in the Utah State game notes. They are the fourth team in the KenPom era to rank in the top five in both defensive rebound percentage and opponent two-point percentage, which we talked about were kind of the strengths of their defense. Intriguingly, two of the other three teams to do that were Tony Bennett teams.
Huh.
Both the 2008-09 Cougars and the 2014-15 Virginia team that he coached, the other being a Bucknell team.
All right.
So what I outlined here as I was thinking about this is, how do the Huskies win this game? And I think there are three key ways they win this. Number one, to get Nimi Ishikata, the Utah State center that we talked about on Sunday, big-time shot blocker, key to their strong defensive rebounding, NBA prospect down the road at some point here. He has been called for at least four fouls in each of his last six games, although that wasn't necessarily like big-time foul trouble in all of those games. Only once in that span did he play fewer than 23 minutes in a game. It was mostly probably the fact that he was playing a lot of minutes allowed him to rack up those fouls. Number two, fairly obviously, make threes against this great interior defense. The Huskies are 17-2 this season when they shoot at least 35% from three-point range. They are 9-6 when they shoot 33.3% or worse. So that is with most teams, been an important key for them to knock down outside shots, and not something I feel super great about the chances of doing. And then the last one is to force turnovers. Utah State is only 4-4 this season when committing turnovers on at least 20% of their possessions, including all three of their non-conference losses. And that's actually a pretty typical game for the Huskies, who average forcing turnovers on 19.8% of opponent possessions. So not only are you stopping Utah State from, you know, scoring on those possessions, also those turnovers, if they're steals, often create opportunities for the Huskies to get out and run in transition and not have to worry about that strong Utah State interior defense. So a high number of steals from Matisse Thybulle.
Interesting.
Very important, naturally, in this game.
Okay. We can get behind that.
Yeah. The other thing I looked at is, you know, kind of how will Utah State attack the zone? And my assumption based on their personnel is they'll probably use their power forward. 6'8" senior Quinn Taylor is the guy in the middle of the zone, the soft middle. He has a pretty good assist rate for a power forward, which is not surprising on a team that ranks sixth in the country in assist rate. And also some range. He's made 23s this season, although not at a great percentage. So he's probably going to be the guy who's going to be asked to do a lot.
Do you feel like as the season wore on in Pac-12 play, that teams were better at attacking the UW zone, or UW lost games because they were just playing bad offensively?
More the former than the latter. I mean, teams did play a little bit better offensively. I think that was also largely related to some regression to the mean from them.
More the latter than the former.
Yeah. Teams scored a little bit better against the Huskies. I think that was mostly related to their three-point percentage regressing to the mean down the stretch, more so than necessarily. And, you know, part of it is, like, there are times where you look at it and say, hey, you know what, the team has a great game plan. Like, they're really attacking the zone well. Like, I felt that about Colorado in the first half on Friday of the Pac-12 semifinals. And they came out in the second half and then just couldn't score at all.
Huh.
So, you know, you can have, part of it is these teams haven't had great personnel, so you can have the best game plan. If you can't execute it, it doesn't do you anything. And Utah State will have better personnel than most Pac-12 teams. All Pac-12 teams, because they would have been the highest rated team in the Pac-12 by a fairly wide margin.
Oh, what conference are they in? Mountain
West. Where they were not the best team in that conference, even though they won the conference tournament. Pac-12 basketball. It's great.
We'd be like a pretty solid Mountain West team.
We'd be a solid number three in the Mountain West. Yeah, I mean, there was a bit of a power vacuum after Nevada and
there
Utah State.
But I'm not worried about the Huskies not defending going into this game.
I agree with that.
If they defend, they'll probably be able to keep the game close. If they can score, I think they could win the game comfortably.
Well, I don't know. You didn't watch the Pac-12 tournament. You're unaware that there's no such thing as a comfortable UW win at this point.
I'm just saying in this hypothetical world that they're able to score.
But still, like, they were up double digits in both of the first two games with, like, 5 minutes left, and it was a shaky finish, to say the least. God. Not as, even shakier than the Blazers last night against the Pacers.
Don't talk about my Blazers.
They won the game. It worked out.
Damn right they did. You saw that the Clippers did that same thing earlier today.
What do you mean?
The Clips let the Pacers get too close
Yes, they did.
But it's like, I feel confident going into this game that they'll be able to defend Utah State. I don't think they're getting run off the court by Utah State. They just need to be able to score.
I didn't think they were getting run off the court by Oregon either, but how did that happen?
Oregon's good.
Oregon is good. And
Oregon would maybe even be the second best team in the Mountain West.
Wow, big there words. Big words. Well, that's bad news because then that would make them as good as Utah State. No, I mean, I think that the Huskies, like, their inability to score kind of bled at some point. Like, they gave up hope a little bit.
Yes.
So
they were already locked in.
That probably won't happen here.
Maybe they went from 32 to 33.
I mean, I don't think they were thinking that way.
Okay, anything else on Utah State?
No, I think that pretty much covers it.
Percentage chances of victory for the Huskies to pick up their first NCAA tournament win of the Mike Hopkins era.
So after all that optimism I gave you, I'm still going to say 40%. I still, you know.
Wow, I thought you were going to say higher than me.
What are you saying?
I mean, it sounds like, it feels like it's close to a 50-50 game. Having seen this Husky team and knowing what they are, right? The stats just don't know what they are, and we do. I can't say that it's a 50-50 game, but I feel like it's closer to 45% than 40.
That's reasonable. I mean, it's somewhere in that range.
There's a solid chance. Okay, so should they get through this game, would they have any chance in hell against North Carolina?
First off, it's a one-game tournament, so yes, they would have a chance against North Carolina. I mean, I don't know how much I buy the whole, like, one day to prepare for the zone thing. And in this case, North Carolina is a somewhat unfavorable matchup to the extent that they're in the ACC and are facing the actual Syracuse zone on a regular basis. So that's unfortunate. You know, they'd be very heavily favored and rightfully so, but I mean, there's a chance.
Okay.
But, you know, I would say we can worry about that matchup if and when it comes to pass.
Yeah, let's just hope that we see that chance.
Let's just see if North Carolina can beat the number 16.
Yeah. That's what we're worried about.
All right. On that note.
Well, again, congrats to Oink for being crowned Seattle's best ramen by the Pelton Cast. Thank you again to Zach Whitman for joining us. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.